Chapter 8. Black Pill. Neoliberalism and the Chicago Turn. The Franklin Roosevelt of 1932 did not much resemble the populist who accepted his party's nomination 4 years later, thundering pugilistic promises to take on the nation's internal enemies. In his campaign against Hoover, Roosevelt sounded like the aristocratic liberal he was said to be, a mild-mannered governor lacking the fire and populist instincts of his distant cousin, Theodore Roosevelt. And yet, when Republicans listened to Roosevelt's promise to relieve America's suffering farmers, they heard the voice of Eugene Debs. When they looked at his shadow, they saw the profile of V.I. Lenin. This conviction was shared by the leader of the Republican Party, Herbert Hoover, who described Roosevelt in a 1932 letter as the latest challenger in a long contest between the nationalists and what we now call Bolsheviks. Following Roosevelt's victory, the most hardline elements of the nation's business community responded in a way consistent with their warnings by attempting to reverse the election by military coup. The plan came apart in the fizzled Wall Street Putsch of 1933, also known as the Banker's Plot. The conservative hatred for Roosevelt survived him, but the political project based on that hatred proved impotent against the institutions that were the New Deal's regulatory and social reform legacy. The New Deal institutions were so popular that they created a new middle lane running through both parties. Dwight Eisenhower, the first post-New Deal Republican president, issued a famously withering dismissal of Republicans who fantasized about rewinding the political clock to the days when the business of America was business, and Andrew Mellon ran the Treasury Department. These nostalgic and embittered conservatives, the president said, represented a splinter group of a few Texas oil millionaires and an occasional politician or businessman from other areas. Their number is negligible and they are stupid. Eisenhower's description of this group as unmoored from reality was correct. No such political project stood a chance. But his summary of the cast was incomplete. It wasn't just a few blustery oilmen and nostalgic rotary clubbers wearing keep cool with Coolidge buttons who sought to correct what they considered the error of the welfare state. At the time of Eisenhower's statement, a transatlantic school of well-funded and well-ensconced intellectuals was a decade into a project to bring about the return of classical liberal economics. This group was not delusional. Its members agreed with Eisenhower's assessment of their near-term prospects. They understood that lobbying and red-baiting could at best be used tactically, as in the defeat of health and disability insurance orchestrated by the AMA, the drug companies, and the Chamber of Commerce. Winning the long game would require more sophisticated methods, a dedication bordering on fanaticism and patience. "If the ideals which I believe unite us are to have any chance of revival," the man at the center of this group declared in 1947, "a great intellectual task must be performed." Friedrich von Hayek was already famous within the economics profession when the road to serfdom made him a global celebrity. In the 1930s, the Austrian-born Hayek established himself at the London School of Economics as a leading theorist of pricing, monetary policy, and business cycles. He approached these subjects with the belief that the market was fundamentally self-balancing and all-knowing. This placed him in direct opposition to John Maynard Keynes, the economist and writer whose ideas dominated mainstream Western economic thinking before, during, and after the war. Hayek's first public encounter with Keynes occurred shortly after his arrival in England from Vienna, when the two economists clashed over the benefits of government spending in the pages of the London Times. The letter exchange was a microcosmic preview of their transatlantic ideological conflict over the shape of the post-war economic order. Until Hayek's death in 1992, Keynes's fluctuating influence would serve as a real-time measure of his own, an indicator of Hayek's value, as the Austrian might have said. Hayek's criticism of Keynes reflected the worldview he developed during the 1920s. In Vienna, Hayek had been an acolyte and colleague of Ludwig von Mises, the figure most responsible for the period's fringe revival of interest in the classical liberal economics of the 19th century. During the war, Hayek used these ideas to frame a contrarian theory of the rise of fascism. The prevailing view in the United States and Britain was that fascism was a phenomenon of the right, emerging in response to the threat liberalism and socialism posed to entrenched private power and traditional hierarchies. Hayek argued the opposite, that fascism was, in fact, a natural progression of the interventionist state, the predictable outcome of collectivism in all its forms. Priming demand with government spending, basic social insurance, macro-managing the economy in any way, these are not bulwarks against tyranny but steps on the road to servitude, as Hayek first titled The Road to Serfdom. The strongest guarantor of individual freedom was the minimalist state described by the classical and neoclassical economists. Only by recognizing the inherently virtuous and self-calibrating nature of market forces could the likes of Adolf Hitler be avoided in the future. The Road to Serfdom sold well in England upon its release in 1944, but it was the U.S. edition published a year later by the University of Chicago Press that changed the course of Hayek's life and much else. In April 1945, Hayek was touring the United States, promoting the Chicago edition of Serfdom, when Reader's Digest released a condensed adaptation. Overnight, Hayek's appearances became standing-room-only events, with crowds lining up to meet the formerly obscure academic. One evening, early into Hayek's new fame, he was preparing to leave an event at the Detroit Economic Club when he was approached by a man named Harold Lunau. The scion of a family manufacturing business in Kansas City, Lunau was in the process of taking control of the family's sleepy philanthropic outfit, the William Volker Charities Fund. He had a clear vision to fund the dissemination and popularization of classical economic ideas and to sponsor free market scholarship like Hayek's book. In Detroit, he proposed to fund another Reader's Digest-style edition of Serfdom, written at a basic level for a popular U.S. audience. Hayek politely demurred, but wasn't quite ready to let Lunau walk away. He countered with an idea of his own, a multi-year academic project focused on the great economic questions of the age. Lunau assented on the spot. The following autumn, Hayek joined several conservative economists at the University of Chicago to launch a five-year study program. Its angle was in the name, the free market study. Though it was Hayek's idea, he would serve as only a part-time participant in the project. When it completed its course in 1951, the free market it championed would be transformed and greatly disfigured by the standards of the Austrian school. But by then, those were no longer the standards being used by adherents of what had become known as the Chicago School. The apple pie version of liberal economic theory contained ingredients not found in the original strudel. The Chicago School developed a tolerance and then an affection for cartels, monopolies, and patents. A multidisciplinary laboratory co-sponsored by the university's law school, business school, and economics department had nurtured Hayek's baby into a new kind of liberalism. In a word, neoliberalism. The free market study tackled a riddle. How to reconcile the theory of the 19th century minimal state with the modern realities of economic concentration, cartelization, and monopoly? For classical economists, monopolies and cartels, seemingly inevitable and intractable features of modern economies, presented an impossible choice. Option 1, violate a core tenet of classical theory and accept the suppression of natural price movements and other anti-competitive distortions resulting from the existence of metastatic concentrations of corporate power. Option 2, risk an expansionist state by permitting it to develop and use far-reaching regulatory powers justified on the grounds that such powers are necessary to protect the basic requirements of a functioning free market. There is no third option. Ludwig von Mises, Hayek's mentor and father of the Austrian school, chose intervention. So too did his most influential students and colleagues, notably Hayek, Arnold Pant, Fritz Machlup, and Michael Polanyi. As a group, Austrian school liberals supported state action to prevent monopolies and maintain the conditions for a competitive economy. When it came to patents, a form of state-protected monopoly, the Austrians had a uniquely simple and elegant solution. Abolish them. Michael Polanyi, one of several scientists associated with the Austrian school, added a philosophical argument to the group's denunciation of patents. Patents, he wrote in 1944, parcel up a stream of creative thought into a series of distinct claims, each of which is to constitute the basis of a separately owned monopoly. But the growth of human knowledge cannot be divided up into such sharply circumscribed phases. Mental progress interacts at every stage with the whole network of human knowledge and draws at every moment on the most varied and dispersed stimuli. Invention is a drama enacted on a crowded stage. Hayek's theory of the economy as a giant information processor left little room for knowledge monopolies. The healthiest economy was one that most efficiently facilitated the natural flow of knowledge. If the economy is knowledge before it is property, then the question of how much of that knowledge should be made into property is of critical importance, writes economic historian Quinn Slobodian. It follows that if you privatize too much or incorrectly, knowledge could also be misallocated, blocked, or left stagnant. Hayek believed monopolies held an even greater danger than distorting prices and competition. The patent-based industrial combines of Nazi Germany demonstrated how monopolies can feed the growth of the state. In The Road to Serfdom, Hayek approvingly cites the temporary National Economic Committee's view that the superior performance of large companies has not been demonstrated, and that the monopoly is obtained by collusion and encouraged by the government. The evils of patents was a recurring theme during 10 days of meetings convened by Hayek at the Mont Pelerin Mountain Resort overlooking Lake Geneva in April 1947. It was there that Hayek and 39 like-minded scholars developed a critique of collectivism that had no place for monopolies on knowledge. A slavish application of the concept of property as it has been developed for material things has done a great deal to foster the growth of monopoly, said Hayek. Here drastic reforms may be required if competition is to be made to work. One member of Hayek's audience had especially strong feelings on intellectual property. In 1934, University of Chicago economist Henry Simons had published a pamphlet, A Positive Program for Laissez-Faire, regarded at the time as the definitive statement of the classical case against patents. The great enemy of democracy is monopoly in all its forms, wrote Simons. The political ends of economic policy were threatened unless the state acted against monopolists to preempt a domination of the state by them. In later works, Simons extended this critique to the state's shameful allowance of gross abuse of patent privilege for extortion, exclusion, and output restriction. In the assessment of historian Robert Van Horn, Simons condemned the patent system because it enabled firms to restrict competition, both actual and potential, and thereby augment their monopoly power. He believed that just as free trade required equal and free access to markets, industrial research required equal and reasonable access, if not wholly free access, to technical knowledge. Simons' view was shared by the group that launched the free market study in 1946. Indeed, they were held to some degree by every major European and American conservative intellectual at the time, including Milton Friedman, the University of Chicago economist destined to become neoliberalism's public face. Only one figure associated with the project dissented from this key tenet of classical orthodoxy. He happened to be the one holding the checkbook. Harold Dunau couldn't claim ignorance of the Austrian school position on patents. The Reader's Digest edition of Serfdom included Hayek's general views on the subject, illustrated by his praise of the New Deal TNEC investigation, and concluded with a warning that great danger lies in the policy of two powerful groups, organized capital and organized labor, which support the monopolistic organization of industry. For American conservatives like Lunau, the Austrian school's focus on organized capital was disposable. A product of European trauma, maybe, a bias based on an understandable obsession with the role of industry in imperial and Nazi Germany. But big business was not a threat in America. The political destination of Lunau and his ilk was not 19th century Holland, which rejected patents in favor of a free trade in inventions, but a second Gilded Age, where corporate titans not only had a God-given right to patents, but could do with them what they goddamn pleased. The conservative revival they envisioned had no place for valorizing the TNEC, and certainly not the antitrust crusade of Thurman Arnold, who continued to haunt corporate America's nightmares, a pen in one hand, the consent decree in the other. Months before the free market study was to begin, an unexpected event released the tension between classical liberal theory and modern American conservatism in Lunau's favor. In June 1946, Henry Simons committed likely suicide by overdosing on barbiturates, a key figure in the development of monetarism and generally considered the most brilliant of the Chicago conservatives. Simons was the Chicago group's antitrust conscience. He did not apologize for advocating the use of state power to maintain an even playing field as the precondition for a free market, and once described the Federal Trade Commission as the most important government agency. Heterodox but consistent, he hated Hoover as much as Roosevelt, and oligopolies and monopolies above all. Lunau knew Simons's views and understood the respect he commanded from the group's members, many of whom had been influenced by Simons's strict 1934 tract, A Positive Program for Laissez-Faire. Following Simons's death, Lunau asked his friend and fellow Chicago economist Aaron Director to take over running the free market study. In his book Goliath, Matt Stoller writes that Lunau had been concerned with Simons's influence and hardline position on monopoly and believed Director to be far more ideologically malleable. For the next 3 years, not much changed, and Director maintained the Simons-Hayek line on monopoly and corporate giantism, which aligned with the views expressed in an address to the 1947 meeting in Mont Pelerin. Current antitrust laws, Director Ed said, should be seen as stopgap measures on the way to more radical restrictions on corporate power. These included limits to the scope of corporate activity, as well as perhaps a direct limitation of the size of corporate enterprise. Director was equally clear in his condemnation of patents as the handmaidens of monopoly and called for dramatic reductions in their terms. Simons would have been proud. Only when funding for the free market study was set to expire in late 1950 did Lunau begin to express himself on the matter. According to historian Rob Van Horn, officials from the Volcker Fund went so far as to threaten to eject Director from his leadership role in the project because the Volcker Fund refused to accept certain tenets of classical liberalism, namely those espoused by the deceased Chicago economist Henry Simons. The evidence suggests Director received the message loud and clear. Later that year, he began a steep public climb down from his former ideologically consistent opposition to monopoly. In a 1950 book review, Director argued that monopolies did not justify state intervention because the corroding influence of competition was their natural enemy and could be counted on to destroy concentrations of economic power. If the market produced monopoly-killing antibodies, then antitrust enforcement and patent reform were unnecessary. At a Chicago conference on corporate law the next year, Director elaborated on his new beliefs. The corporate form was ideal, he said, because it did not contribute toward business monopoly. According to his updated views, anything that emerges from the market is by definition a natural expression of the market and therefore inherently less threatening and coercive than powers granted to government. Less than 5 years after the FMS began, writes Van Horn, Director's belief that concentrations of business power were relatively benign became, for the Chicago School, an assertion of fact. When the free market study expired in 1952, its principal figures were all moving toward accommodating the new Chicago doctrine of benign monopoly. Completing this ideological journey would be the focus of the next Lunau-funded project at the University of Chicago called the Antitrust Project. The Antitrust Project was designed to interrogate and revise the traditional legal and economic interpretations of monopoly in America and the antitrust movement that arose to challenge it. It aimed to achieve a redefinition of the functions of the state, as Hayek said in one of his Sermons on the Mount. But its redefinition was not of the sort Hayek had in mind. Over the next several years, the project produced a multi-volume revisionist history of antitrust that reversed conventional legal and economic thought on the subject. The project's breakout star was a young Chicago legal scholar named Robert Bork. A talented writer and polemicist, Bork produced some of the project's earliest reappraisals of the Sherman Antitrust Act and related case law. His writings defending the legality and competitive advantages of vertical mergers were as fulsome as his condemnations of antitrust actions were withering. Not to be outdone, Director produced articles targeting the most celebrated, least controversial antitrust suits in the country's history. These included the 1911 Supreme Court decision that dismembered Standard Oil, a judgment that Director dismissed as without merit and counterproductive. In a 1956 project article that anticipated later theories about shareholder value, Director and Chicago Law School Dean Edward Levi argued that corporations benefited the wider economy by practicing exclusionary and anti-competitive behavior. Hayek did not join his colleagues in this sharp ideological turn. He spent 1959, his last year in Chicago, writing a book that contained a forceful restatement of the Austrian school's traditional opposition to patents in all forms of monopoly. Knowledge, Hayek wrote in The Constitution of Liberty, once achieved, becomes gratuitously available for the benefit of all. It is through this free gift of the knowledge acquired by the experiments of some members of society that general progress is made possible, that the achievements of those who have gone before facilitate the advance of those who follow. In his final book published in 1988, Hayek continued to espouse this view and cites his fellow Austrian Fritz Matklub on the inherently anti-competitive nature of patents and copyrights. In October 1958, academic libraries across the United States and Europe received the debut issue of a new periodical published out of Chicago by figures associated with the Antitrust Project. Its title gave a name to the movement led by Director, Bork, and others to systematize their apostate beliefs on monopoly and patents. The first slate of articles in the Journal of Law and Economics included pieces on monopoly policy and prices in medicine, reflecting the ideological distance traveled by its editorial board in the previous decade, but also changes behind the scenes. The Volcker Fund was no longer the only sponsor of the antitrust project, but it had been joined by a second wave of funders. One was the family foundation of Eli Lilly, the Indiana drug giant. It was Lilly money that launched the journal, a fact that likely inspired the young publication's interest in regulatory debates impacting the medical and pharmaceutical industries. Some of these pieces had the trappings of traditional scholarship. Others read like screeds. Many fell somewhere in between, such as British economist D.S. Lees's attempt to try and unravel once and for all the twisted logic that underlies the National Health Service and its threat to principles and aims consistent with the basic assumptions of a free society. Until the late 1950s, the drug companies hadn't paid much notice to the arcane intellectual experiment at the University of Chicago. This changed when Kefauver announced he was extending his anti-monopoly hearings to include the drug industry. Their interest sharpened following the passage of the Kefauver-Harris Amendments in 1962, an event that demonstrated the limits of its skipping record drug story public relations narrative and its Cold War meets Chamber of Commerce political strategy. The expansion of FDA powers placed the industry's product chain under the purview of a government agency for the first time, a development the public overwhelmingly supported. If not quite as worrying as attacks on its patent privileges, the regulatory state's new powers over drug development and sales was nonetheless serious. The industry's critics, meanwhile, viewed it as a work in progress. Before his death in 1963, Kefauver had cultivated and inspired a coterie of protégés, notably Gaylord Nelson, the liberal governor of Wisconsin, who arrived in the Senate earlier that year. The Chicago figure who most intrigued the industry was the economist George Stigler. A late arrival to the antitrust project, Stigler joined the Chicago faculty from Columbia University in 1958, just in time to contribute an article on economies of scale to the first issue of the Journal of Law and Economics. Like his new colleagues, Stigler was once a devotee of Henry Simons and had maintained a classical liberal's antipathy toward monopolies, cartels, and patents. In 1942, Stigler published a pro-competition treatise that endorsed the TNEC and the antitrust offensive of Thurman Arnold's Justice Department. In a 1945 speech to the American Economic Association, Stigler condemned monopolies as an evil demanding correction and called the case for reducing patent terms irrefutable. Stigler no longer believed this when he arrived in Chicago in 1958 and made regulation the focus of his work, with a special interest in the drug industry's travails with Congress and the FDA. During his first years in Chicago, Stigler developed the economic theory for which he is best remembered, regulatory capture. Stigler argued that because industries targeted by state regulation have more at stake than the public or the agency overseeing the regulation, those industries will inevitably gain control of the process. The danger described by the theory was real enough, but the elder Stigler no longer advocated the countermeasures he embraced during the 1930s and 40s. Namely, strengthening democratic oversight and checking the runaway growth of concentrated corporate power. The Chicago version of Stigler was a servant of corporate power and embodied neoliberalism's open animus to majoritarian rule. At a 1978 meeting of the Mont Pelerin Society, Stigler would recommend the restriction of the franchise to property owners, educated classes, employed persons, or some such group. This aspect of Chicago-engineered neoliberalism, never well hidden, rushed into view when prominent figures associated with the movement signed on as advisors to right-wing police states in Chile and Argentina, justifying state torture as easily as they now justified state-protected monopolies. The other solution to the phenomenon of regulatory capture was the one Stigler's friend and colleague Milton Friedman advocated in his weekly Newsweek column. Abolish the agencies and leave regulation to consumers in the free market. Stigler saw Friedman's position as the media performance it was, good for chumming the waters of public backlash against the activist state, perhaps, but unrealistic and crude. Most important, he believed abolishing the agencies was unnecessary. If you believed in an industry's natural right to determine its own behavior, capture was not a problem. It was an art. In his study of Stigler, the historian Edward Nicot writes that the Chicago economist believed in several ways to skin a cat, his chosen euphemism for gaining dominance over government regulators. As chair of the University of Chicago Business School's Governmental Control Project, and later his own fiefdom, the Center for the Study of the Economy and the State, Stigler theorized how major industries could go about skinning their particular regulatory cats while wearing Cheshire grins. He recommended that industries threatened with regulation go beyond traditional lobbying and instead aim to control the mental frames and vocabularies used by regulators and the public. What began as a study of the nature and extent of governmental control of the economy came to explore methods for how to control the government, says Nick Kah. If the ideas developed by Stigler during the 1960s seemed precision-engineered to help an embattled drug industry, that's because they were. As with every Chicago school project since the late 1950s, Stigler's policy shop was wide open for business. Preferring to work for patrons uncontaminated by the egalitarian views of the government and the public at large, writes Nika, Stigler found them in corporations and pro-market foundations. The topics Stigler settled on, studies of the economy and the state, had the virtue of appealing to a paying clientele. To a pharmaceutical industry still recounting the same old drug story in pamphlets and the Saturday Evening Post, Stigler's blueprints for colonizing the brain and organs of government must have appeared visionary, if not futuristic. Stigler would teach the industry to control its own destiny, not by throwing red paint at the FDA and placing editorials calling for its abolition, but by reshaping the thinking and priorities of its administrators and affiliated scientists, politicians, and the public, all without them even knowing it was happening. The promised land described by Stigler was not regulatory capture, but cognitive capture. For the drug companies, this opened up a number of possibilities. Some lines of attack were already underway and awaiting their support, such as Robert Bork's revisionist project to rewrite the histories of antitrust law and patent populism. Others remained in the planning stage, such as establishing quasi-academic research centers to produce papers and books. These centers would serve as echo chambers to ensure the industry's message rang continuously in the public square. It was Stigler's belief that, if crafted and disseminated with care, anything put through this system would in time be internalized by scientists, regulators, and the public. In 1971, a small group of Pfizer executives visited Hyde Park to meet with the dean of the University of Chicago Law School, Phil Neal. Like other companies with an interest in regulation, Pfizer was curious to know what funding opportunities existed to support the work of Stigler and other neoliberals working along similar lines and providing similar services. The movement's biggest corporate funder at the time was General Electric, sponsor of the school's Government Business Relations Program, as well as the work of Robert Bork, who had become a human antitrust revisionist tornado, bouncing between courtrooms and boardrooms in a crusade to make the world safe for monopoly. If the Pfizer executives debriefed the law school dean about the enemies at the drug industry's gate, it may have been a long meeting. In 1967, Wisconsin Democrat Gaylord Nelson picked up Gefauver's mantle in the Senate Subcommittee on Antitrust and Monopoly and initiated hearings on competitive problems in the pharmaceutical industry. He also revived Gefauver's mission to reduce the terms and scope of drug monopolies and proposed a law to require the prescribing of generic drugs over their branded versions. Nelson and the cause of patent reform entered the 1970s with a new ally at their side, the National Consumer Rights Movement. The face of this movement was a young lawyer named Ralph Nader, famous for challenging the automobile industry with the public safety argument described in his 1965 exposé, Unsafe at Any Speed. Justice Gefauver's hearings featured cameos by veterans of the Kilgore hearings. Nelson's hearings contained a number of links to Eisenhower and Kennedy-era hearings. More than a decade after Gefauver grilled Park Davis executives about their fatal overprescription of the antibiotic chloramycetin, Nelson summoned them back to answer reports that the company was continuing to promote use of the drug to treat conditions for which it had no known activity. When the executives admitted Park Davis was not using the warning labels on its U.S. packaging in exports targeting the markets of developing countries, Nelson told them, "I don't see how you people can sleep at night." The industry's recent success in loosening the Kennedy patent policy at HEW, meanwhile, was a limited one. The Nixon administration adopted a relatively hard line on antitrust similar to its Democratic predecessors. In 1970, a deputy attorney general in the Justice Department announced a watch list of 9 patent and licensing practices that would be prosecuted as anti-competitive restraints of trade. The list of nine no-nos, as it came to be known, set like bowling pins for the Chicago school's antitrust bowling ball, Robert Bork, for the remainder of the decade. In 1974, another of Nixon's assistant attorney generals declared private patent claims on government inventions unconstitutional. This was the backdrop of the two-day conference on the regulation of the introduction of new pharmaceuticals hosted by the law school during the first week of December 1972. The university was an ironic location for this, having declared in 1944 a strict no-profit policy for its faculty members, based on the belief that the advancement of scientific knowledge depends on the free interchange and use of the ideas and information between scientists and research workers within a university. The basic purpose of university research may be thwarted if the free exchange or use of such information is checked or prevented by the attempt of one or a group of faculty members to profit from patentable discoveries. By removing any such incentive, the patent rule of the University of Chicago ensures that the cooperative search for truth is untrammeled. The agenda brought two worlds face to face. Professors affiliated with the law and economics movement delivered critical talks on regulation and the 1962 Kefauver-Harris amendments. Drug company executives and their research directors delivered papers of their own. Each reinforced an understanding of current FDA regulations as unnecessary and counterproductive. In most cases, the presentations were more political than scientific or scholarly, or the data they rested upon. When the conference papers were published as a book, Regulating New Drugs, it was roundly panned in the scientific press for advocating ideas so at variance with the current thinking in this field that they will be subject to much criticism, as one reviewer put it. The book's critics did not yet understand that establishing a counter-narrative at variance with the current thinking was the point of the conference. The conclave of executives and neoliberal academics was a watershed event in the development of the modern drug industry. Over the course of the 1970s, alumni of the Chicago Conference would build out an industry-funded pseudo-scientific echo chamber with the aim of setting the terms of political debate and co-opting the experts with finesse, in words of an influential 1978 Stiglerian tract called The Regulation Game. In 1974, conference participants became the first hires at the Center for Health Policy Research, a drug policy think tank funded with industry money at the American Enterprise Institute. 2 years later, another conference alumnus, the clinical scientist turned FDA critic, Louis Lasagna, started the Center for the Study of Drug Development at the University of Rochester. After joining the neoliberal side of the regulation debate, Lasagna became a frequent writer for The Good Drugs Do, a public-facing newsletter published by the medical advertising agency headed by Arthur Sackler, who would later hire Lasagna as dean of the Sackler Graduate School of Biomedical Sciences at Tufts University. Both centers were organized around the production of research designed to reset the drug debate. Success came quickly. One of the first memes produced by the CSDD was the drug lag. This was the idea that excessive safety regulations were hurting public health by deterring investments in research and delaying the arrival of new drugs on the market. As Daniel Carpenter notes in his History of the FDA, the idea that regulation stifled innovation emerged from these corporate-funded centers and quietly took root in public and academic debates. A key vector involved studies and articles funded by leading drug firms, which were then distributed without disclosures, leading to the citation in mainstream journals and use in clinical pharmacology and economics programs. The new think tanks were publicity hives for finessing and packaging industry messages. Previous generations of industry publicists had allowed scripts to go stale. The post-Chicago machine was more dynamic. Even old standbys about patents driving innovation were updated and given shines. Some of these variations had more legs than others. One notable dud belonged to Edmund Kitch, a Chicago law professor and veteran of the 1972 conference, who published an article in 1977 praising patent monopolies for preventing wasteful duplication in the drug market. But there was always money to fund novel approaches to a genre that reached terminal rhetorical velocity in Michael Novak's 1996 Pfizer-funded philosophical essay on the moral and godly basis of patent monopolies, the fire of invention, the fuel of interest. Half a century after this echo chamber hatched from an industry-academia networking and strategy event, it continues to perform the functions Stigler imagined for it, shaping and policing the boundaries of the drug pricing debate, awaiting activation at key moments. In the early 2000s, the system released the meme of the $800 million pill, cited by George W. Bush as a justification for signing away the government's right to negotiate drug prices in the 2003 Medicare Prescription Drug Improvement and Modernization Act. The industry is constantly revising the meme, which at the time of writing is the $2 billion pill. The drug industry network built in the mid-1970s, one able to produce propaganda and send it reverberating through the wider culture, served as a model for the tobacco and fossil fuel industries, who faced similar regulatory and political threats related to their impacts on public health. Oil companies were especially precocious students of Stiglerian ideas about co-opting experts with funding. Following a 1969 oil spill off the coast of Santa Barbara, California, state agencies were dumbfounded when every local scientist with relevant expertise refused to testify against the companies, because every one of them was being funded in whole or in part by the industry. With time, this echo chamber would learn to tarnish and weaken the impact of any findings and research that threatened industry interests. In the name of science, data wielded by critics would be dismissed as adversarial and fundamentally unserious. The point of pharma's echo chamber was never to get the public to support monopolistic pricing, says Nick Kah. As with global warming denialism, which involves many of the same institutions, the goal was to forestall regulation by sowing confusion about the relationship among prices, profits, innovation, and patents. He continues, Stigler and those influenced by his work had very sophisticated ideas about how to audit and slowly take over the agencies by getting them to internalize their positions and critiques. You target public conceptions of medical science. You target the agency's understanding of what they're supposed to do. You target the very thing inputted into the regulatory bodies. You commercialize science. Outside of Chicago, Stigler, his students, and those in their close orbit developed relationships with scientists, resulting in a variety of interlinked and coordinated research institutes spanning economics, politics, and the biomedical sciences. Perhaps the slyest Stiglerian tactic of all was a trend that emerged following The Economist's death in 1991. Industry-funded academic chairs in bioethics. By the century's end, such sinister moves were routine practice, decorative touches for what had become an expansive pharmaceutical idea factory. The base victory was won decades earlier with the triumph of the neoliberal obsession with objective cost-benefit analysis. This product of Chicago's laboratories was noted by the philosopher Michel Foucault in a lecture at the College of France in 1979. The defining and most effective characteristic of U.S. neoliberalism's permanent criticism of governmental policy, said Foucault, was the reductionist use of quantification to test government action, gauge its validity, and to object to activities of the public authorities on the grounds of their abuses, excesses, utility, and wasteful expenditure. It targets the activity of the numerous federal agencies established since the New Deal, and especially since the end of the Second World War, such as the Food and Health Administration. Foucault delivered this speech in March 1979. Whether he knew it or not, the industry campaign that incubated this strategy was nearing an endgame in Washington, D.C., where George Stigler and Milton Friedman would soon be honored guests of a U.S. president who agreed monopolies were benign, and that the drug companies deserved everything they ever wanted, and perhaps a few things more.